Okay, so I'll be talking about this recent preprint, which certainly was the main author was Laurens van der Staten, a postdoc in Ghent. And then this was also in collaboration with Michael Margen, a former PhD student of Frank in Ghent, who unfortunately quit academia. And then Norbert Schuch, Julien Vidal, and with Frank, of course. So I'd like to thank the organizers for organizing this conference and inviting me. So this conference about tensor networks for quantum field theories, two actually. In this talk, I actually want to go the opposite direction and ask the question, can we use quantum field theory IDs for tensor networks? Or more generally, the kind of what we're really interested in, or what I'm really interested in, research-wise, is basically what can we learn, or how can we basically extend this synergy between tensor networks and quantum field theories, which clearly is fully developing. And with this, I would actually like to make small advertisement that if people are interested in doing research and as a PhD or postdoc. In this direction, they're very welcome to contact me. There is some funding for this in Ghent, which, as you can see, also is a beautiful city to live in. So to get to an overview of my talk, I'll start by really reminding you of some very basic facts. I guess everybody will know what will be said in these first 2 points about both perturbation theory and about the variational principle or variational ansatzen in quantum field theories and more generally quantum many body theories. And then what this talk is about developing variational wave functions inspired by perturbation theory. So this was already mentioned also by Steve this morning. This is a general principle. I mean, that's been around in physics. It's been used also in quantum chemistry and many fields. But we'll consider what tensor networks how tensor networks can benefit this from this. I'll give some examples. So as this is the last talk of today, I guess a lot of the external speakers are still jet lagged, including myself. So I'll try to keep it concise. We're still in this first day, which was supposed to be about the real world. Models, I think I'm already very much in this Disneyland type of models with these examples here. And then finally, there will be a summary and an outlook. So just general perturbation theory features in every course in quantum mechanics. You all know these formulas. So P naught is just the projector onto the ground state, or 1 minus P naught is just the projector onto the orthogonal complement of the ground state. So it's definitely, perturbation theory is definitely one of the cornerstones of quantum field theory, where it's typically cast in terms of Feynman diagrams and Green's functions. And it has proven crucial for obtaining some of the most famous results in QED, but then also in high energy or short distance QCD. Thanks to asymptotic freedom, perturbation theory also works in that case. And of course, perturbative expansions appear throughout many body physics and statistical mechanics. For example, the low and high temperature expansions. And so the basic idea, or well, some of the problems of perturbation theory are of course also very well known. Many perturbative expansions are divergent. So for example, the perturbative energy that you get out of this is neither a lower bound nor an upper bound. There's no kind of underlying variational principle, and can even diverge as you increase your order of perturbation theory. There are many interesting effects in physics which are intrinsically non-perturbative. Most famous, of course, the confinement problem in QCD. And then you can also wonder, for example, if you have two gapped phases where you can construct perturbative expansions, but these phases are separated by a quantum critical point. How can you connect them? How can you bridge them? That's in the title of the talk. So that's one of the kind of crucial questions that we had in mind when starting this project. And so the basic idea is just to use the perturbative expansion of the wave function as a kind of inspiration to build a variational ansatz. Namely, just by having this perturbative coefficient that would appear here, replace it by a variational parameter and just optimize over it. Now, if you do this for a quantum many body system or a quantum field theory, the first problem is, well, sketched here. So this is even more simple than really using the exact perturbative expansion. It's really just using kind of the H interacting here without actually this denominator that you have. If you use this kind of ansatz for the harmonic oscillator, it will work quite well for single particle quantum mechanics. But then if you try to do the same idea in quantum field theory, like the lambda phi 4 theory, you treat this interaction term as a perturbation, you construct the analogous ansatz, and you do the variational optimization, you will actually find that the variational optimum just has beta equal to 0. And this has to do with size extensivity. This, such an ansatz is not size extensive. It doesn't have the right volume scaling. And therefore, in the thermodynamic limit, which a quantum field theory is necessarily defined in, or you will just find that this does not give you a correction, so that basically you just end up with your original Gaussian, which you also write down for, which would be the correct solution just for the free field theory, but so you're not gaining anything over just using this Gaussian. So what you actually want to use is this size extensive wave function. But then you have to find a way of working with this kind of expression, because if you want to evaluate any kind of expectation value with this, what you'll end up with is evaluating a path integral in a sense, but just only over the spatial coordinates. So this d here, this exponent d, is just the spatial dimensions. So
doesn't the problem arise by trying to convert the perturbation theory into a variational? An ansatz with a wave function. I mean, the perturbation itself behaves well in the system itself.
Indeed, but it's if you want to convert it into a variational ansatz, that's kind of the message here. You cannot just do it like this. You want to have something which is an ansatz which is size extensive, but to lowest order, it would still reproduce. Well, as I said, this is not really the correct perturbation result because it doesn't include the denominator. But I will get back to this and the not the next slide, but the slide after that. So these problems I just highlighted are very well known. They were actually pointed out by Feynman in one of his last talks, or I think even his very last talk, at a conference in Wangerooge, West Germany. And so he highlights three problems. The first one is actually the problem that was very well answered by Martin in the previous talk. So the question, what is the problem with dealing with relativistic theories? It's indeed the sensitivity to high frequencies. So all the variational freedom you have will actually be used just to optimize the short range degrees of freedom. In this talk, we will avoid this just by working on the lattice. So we will actually be working with lattice models. And then the second thing is, well, the only things you can actually work with is, so either you just restrict to Gaussian states, so 2 and 3 are not complementary. That's actually, so either you only restrict to Gaussian states, or if you want to do something which goes beyond this, you need the size extensive wave functions, and then you have to figure out a way of actually dealing with them. And the point is, you want to be able to implement the variational principle, you want to be able to compute the energy expectation value at the very least. And you have to do this accurately. If you don't do this accurately, if you say, well, I will use this size extensive wave function, but then to compute the energy expectation value, I will resort to perturbation theory again, this is not going to work.
You keep saying size extensive. Can you tell me exactly what you mean by that?
So this is a term which certainly is also around in quantum chemistry. It has to do with, you want your ansatz to perform equally well independent of the size of the system or the number of particles in the case of quantum chemistry. And for this, in a many-body system, what you need is the way to think about perturbation theory, for example, is you have your ground state of your non-interacting system or of your H0, and then the way that you want to approximate the ground state of the perturbed system is by including some interactions on top of this. But what the perturbation theory gives you is really just like adding a finite number of interactions on top of your non-interacting ground state or your psi zero. Whereas what you need to have size extensivity is really a density of excitations on top of your on top of your ground state. And that's what these kind of wave functions do. So let me get to this general framework. So suppose we have some kind of Hamiltonian, which consists of two sets of terms. It's an interpolation between two Hamiltonians, H0 and H1. So we don't restrict to the case of just having one H0 and then a perturbation. We want to be able to deal either way. So we want to be able to start from H0 and perturb with H1, or the other way around. And suppose both H0 and H1 themselves, they have simple ground states. For example, just product states is one example. It doesn't have to be like that, but just something which you can easily describe. And even more, for which you can actually easily find an interpolating wave function. So it's just some kind of ansatz, which for alpha equals 0 gives you the ground state of H0, and alpha equals 1 gives you the ground state of H1. So for example, a mean field ansatz. If indeed the mean field ansatz is a correct ground state for H0 and H1, but not in between, this could be your starting point. And now we're going to address it with perturbative corrections. So these are these operators that you see appearing, and just for this would just be first order perturbation theory. But in first order perturbation theory, you would just add these in a kind of sum, in a kind of linear combination, psi 0 plus this v 0 1 acting on psi 0. Here we will apply them in an exponential. And this is what makes it size extensive. This is what makes that you create a kind of density of excitations. And so if you now write down, for example, this three-parameter family of states, we can capture the first-order perturbative results around H0 and around H1 by treating them as variational parameters and just doing the variational optimization. You're actually able to interpolate nicely between these two perturbative expansions. And if there's a critical point in between, well, I'll show you some results for very simple examples, and it just seems to perform pretty well. And of course, you can extend this, so now you can add another exponential, which contains the operator for that you need to include the second-order perturbative result, and et cetera. And there seems to be some ambiguity here in how do you order this, which one of those two exponentials you put first. So actually, what we will be doing is not exactly this, for the reason that, well, to implement this variational principle, as I said, you still have to compute expectation values. And for this, it's actually, this is where tensor networks come into play. So by mapping these kind of wave functions to tensor network states, or more generally, actually, by mapping these exponentials into tensor network operators acting on this simple psi alpha state, we will be able to use just all the machinery of tensor networks to actually compute energy expectation values. And the tensor network operator that we're constructing for the examples on the next slides, they will actually be more symmetric. So they will basically have the same, they will capture the same order of perturbation theory, but they will actually be slightly more symmetric than this product of exponentials.
Sorry, Lito, can you just give me some intuition for this using perturbation theory to address the mean field?
Well, this way you're at least sure that you capture the first correction, I mean, the lowest order correction to the ground state away from, I mean, starting from H0, perturbing by H1.
But so perturbations of what? So psi alpha goes from 0 to 1?
Yes, but so psi alpha goes from 0 to 1, but psi alpha is only a ground state at alpha equals 0. It's a ground state of H0, and at alpha equals 1, it's a ground state of H1. But then anywhere in between, it's just a very crude approximation, like mean field theory. So suppose indeed that, so let me just switch to the examples, and I think things will become more clear. So as I said, we're in Disneyland type of models. So 2D Ising and transverse magnetic fields. Written like this, we have an H0 and an H1, which are extremely simple. Their ground states are just product states, polarized in the x direction and polarized in the plus z or minus z direction, respectively. So now as a psi alpha, what we use is just this state, which is still a product state. And indeed, so at alpha equals 0, it's just polarized in the x direction. at alpha equals 1, this becomes a projectron to spin up the polarized in the plus z direction state up to some normalization, which, I mean, we of course take care of in the tensor network representation. So this is still a product state. That would just be mean field theory. And if you now use this, just as psi alpha as an ansatz for this 2D Ising model, what you get is for the magnetization, this blue curve, so the well-known mean field results, which already gives you a second order transition, but of course with mean field critical exponents and very much off the correct transition value of these parameters. Now, for example, to capture what we now do is apply on top of the state some kind, so now it's just a product state, we apply some kind of tensor network operator on this. So this is indeed this pictorial representation of these tensors. So these tensors are now, so maybe I should have now in a full tensor network as well. So what you do is you just cover a 2D lattice with these tensors, and then the lines which have explicit labels here, explicit indices, you all connect them. So these are the virtual bonds in your tensor network. And then this line is a pictorial representation of which operator you're applying on that site. So in this particular case, if you have 0, 0, 0, 2, you would apply a Z operator. And so just by, for example, applying this, for example, just the very first one, if suppose you only have this, well, then it's still basically a product of local operators. So it would still, if you apply this on your product state, you still end up with a product state. But by doing this, starting from the alpha equal 1 state, so it all spins up, by just applying this product of operators, you're already able to basically capture the first order perturbation result if you perturb with this X field. Vice versa, if you start from alpha equals 0, so the polarized in the X direction, and you apply this tensor network operator, which now actually has bond dimension 2, so there is a 1 here. And you actually also need, so everything is rotation invariant. So if you draw this picture, it's also the same if you have a 1 here or a 1 there or a 1 there. So what this does is if you have a 1 somewhere, then the next site will also have to be a 1. So you actually be applying an XX, a nearest neighbor XX operator onto your, I'm sorry, this is, well, yeah, okay. So what this is doing is it's not the, so this is actually generating the second order perturbation results starting from the all spins up state, so from the polarized in the Z direction. So I was mistaken before. So the first thing here is what you need to capture first order perturbation theory starting from the ground state of ZZ and perturbing with X. This gives you the second order perturbation theory. And that's indeed, not the other way around. So to start from the other case, to start from this term where you have alpha equals 0, you start with polarized in the X direction state. To capture first order perturbation theory, you already need a BEPS with bond dimension 2. So then you could actually forget about those two. So then you would just need this guy, which, like that one, will apply a ZZ on nearest neighbors on just a link. But that's what you actually need for first order perturbation theory for that perturbation. And then these things you need to actually capture also second order perturbation theory with starting from the ground state of this and applying this as a perturbation. So, but now we just incorporate these together in a tensor network operator with bond dimension 3, apply it to this product state. So we get a PEPS with bond dimension 3, which has these 1, 2, 3, 4 parameters. And so if you do this, so I already said the blue curve is the magnetization obtained from mean field, so only having the alpha. The red curve is only including first order perturbation theory, so that's actually this first column here. So that would be a PEPS with bond dimension 2 and 2 free parameters, gives you this red curve. And then if you include all of this, you get a PEPS with bond dimension 3, 4 free parameters, and you get this yellow curve, which is already I mean, certainly a lot of a big improvement over the mean field result and already pretty close. It's not, I mean, if you do a full-fledged variational PEPS calculation with bond dimension T, you get slightly, I mean, you get slightly closer to the critical point. But it's already very good. And especially what turns out if you do these optimizations is that typically you find the transition point much sharper than if you just use a completely generic PEPS. This inset here, you might think that this is also just the same order parameter again, zoomed into. That's actually not the case. What this inset is doing is just showing you this, basically this alpha parameter. And so this, in a sense, acts as a kind of virtual order parameter. It just shows you there is, the point is this tensor network operator does not break the symmetry of the Ising model, so the product of all x's. So the Z2 symmetry of the Ising model is perfectly respected by the tensor network operator. It's only broken here at the level of this mean field state. And so by just measuring the value of alpha, you get some other kind of order parameter, which does not correspond directly to a physical operator. So for this standard quantum phase transition going between symmetry breaking and symmetry respecting state, there is no need for a new order parameter, but the use of this will become clear in a second. And so here are just the values that you would find if you would just use, if you want to replicate perturbation theory up to second order, starting from the polarized, so from this as H0 and this as perturbation.
Previously, you defined your operators with an energy denominator, which could be non-trivial.
Yes.
Is that trivial here?
In this case, it's trivial. I actually glanced over this. I should have spent 10 seconds more time talking about this. Where was it? Here. So indeed, in principle, this complicates matters. For gap systems, you expect this this V operator to still be quasi-local. For example, you could use a formalism of quasi-adiabatic evolution of Hastings to rewrite this. You could, there are other ways to do it, but if you have a mass gap, then you still expect this V operator to be quasi-local. So you will need to do some approximations or some tricks to actually cast this exponential of this operator into a tensor network. But we're confident that this still can be done. But actually, indeed, for the talk I'm giving here, we will actually consider examples where this just becomes completely local, where it becomes trivial.
In this construction, why is the gamma 1 identity terms, they seem to have to close a loop before they contribute, right? Indices too?
Yeah, no, it connects to this one. So what you need for the second order perturbation theory acting with this as a perturbation is something like Z identity Z acting on three consecutive sites or also over a corner. So that's what these two are doing. So the lowest order, what this does is indeed just connecting to this guy. So to put a Z on this side and a Z on that side here and an identity on that side.
Why doesn't it have all lengths?
But indeed, it does also include all lengths. But I mean, if I've written beta 2 here. That's actually supposed to be a gamma 1. There's no beta 2 in this table. So these higher lengths will just be, I mean, if you just plug in the perturbative results, they will just be higher order, and I mean, they will have higher order. So that will basically mean that, suppose you now want to include third order perturbation theory, you already have to indeed check what this gives you as a third order term, and then only have to include some new diagrams to basically capture the difference between what you already have from this construction and what you still, I mean, what perturbation theory is telling you that you actually need. Now, one of the nice things of casting this whole formalism as a tensor network, as a PEPS, is that PEPS provide an intrinsic one-dimensional Hilbert space or one-dimensional lattice system to define entanglement degrees of freedom, and in particular, an entanglement Hamiltonian. So in these cases, if you construct a PEPS transfer matrix, well, especially because it's symmetric, The entanglement Hamiltonian is just related to the fixed point of the transfer matrix, which we can also represent as a matrix product state. And so you can really just plug in your perturbative PEPS tensor, get a perturbative expansion of your transfer matrix, and then get a perturbative expansion of your fixed point of this, and then take a logarithm of this. It's not entirely straightforward. There are some caveats in there, especially since at zeroth order, I mean, you just have a product state, and so your fixed point would just be a rank one object. And then to define this logarithm, you essentially what you need to do is also have some kind of exponential version of extensive version of the perturbation theory for that fixed point. And so that's the difference between this first line and the second line. So these P plus and minus operators are just a fancy way to write down the projectorum to spin up or spin down. And so you get some kind of perturbative expression. So this epsilon is related to this lambda 1 over lambda 0. You get some perturbative expansion for your density matrix, and then you can take a logarithm of this. And indeed, this actually gives you something rather strange. So you have something which is, so this is basically has a U1 symmetry. It just spin ups and spin down, so it commutes with Z. And what happens if you take this logarithm is that the part in here that commutes with this all Zs, actually the epsilon squared is reduced to an epsilon, whereas the part which does not commute with the Zs, you get an epsilon squared log epsilon. So there are some kind of, not difficulties, but some kind of strange things going on if you take this logarithm. And you have to be a bit careful with these calculations and to conclude to which order this is accurate. But it's still, very interesting that with this formalism you can just write down an analytic expression for an entanglement Hamiltonian, which is naturally defined on a one-dimensional system, on a boundary system of your region. So this is certainly something I don't think you can easily do with other ways of doing perturbation or variational perturbation theory in any kind of fashion. Another example, let me first tell you something about topological order in PEPS. A necessary condition to have topological order in PEPS is that there is something called an MPO symmetry. So this is, it's a kind of virtual symmetry of the PEPS tensor. There exists some kind of objects that you can pull through your PEPS tensor. We don't need to complete, so these MPOs, I think Frank will also talk more about this. They generate some kind of algebra, et cetera, but we don't need the full complexity. Here we will just look at the Torre code, which is an extremely simple case of this, where this MPO is just reduced to products of operators which just form a Z2 group, so just X's. Let me mention here that this is a necessary condition. It doesn't necessarily imply that you have topological order. This depends on what's in your tensor. And the way to verify this is by looking at the fixed point structure of this transfer matrix. So I defined this transfer matrix on this previous slide. This fixed point, in the case of topological order, this fixed point is actually not unique. There is some some kind of symmetry breaking, but actually also there can also be some kind of SPT order in these fixed points. And by carefully analyzing this pattern of symmetry breaking SPT order, you can at least, in this reference, it's explained for the case of Zn quantum doubles, how you from this pattern in the fixed point of the transfer matrix can conclude what the physically realized topological order is. So there is some kind of relation between the symmetry breaking and the fixed point and anion condensation going on at the physical level. So as I said, we will just look at the Torrey code perturbed by a magnetic field. So people will probably immediately tell me, well, this model is just exactly dual to this transverse Ising model, so you're not doing anything new. From the PEPS point of view, it's slightly different from this formalism, so that's why we decided to look at it. So in this case, our psi alpha is not just a product state, because the ground state of the Torrey code is not a product state, but it's still a very simple PEPS with one dimension two. And you can actually construct a state which interpolates nicely between just polarized in the x direction at alpha equals 0, and then the ground state of the target code at alpha equals 1. And it's actually also only at alpha equals 1 that you would have this MPO symmetry or this Z2 symmetry of the previous slide. So in a sense, this from the tensor matrix point of view, the alpha is triggering an explicit breaking of this symmetry and this fixed point structure of the tensor matrix. You could actually also have the spontaneous symmetry breaking. So that's what I was talking about on this previous slide. Even if you have the symmetry at the level of the PEPS tensor and at the level of the tensor matrix, it could still be spontaneously broken, or there could be some kind of non-trivial SPT order which still breaks your physical topological order. But in this case, if alpha is different from 1, you will explicitly transition away from topological order. And then I'm not going to explain in detail again how these kind of operators can capture all the perturbative expansions, but you can indeed check this. And so just by having in the end, so we generalized it even more a little bit. So we include some more terms that are not directly inspired by, or well, they are in a sense inspired by perturbation theory, but generalized a little bit. So we have in the end, I think 10, so 5 gammas, 5 deltas, and 1 alpha is 11 parameters in a PEPS of bond dimension 2 from the psi alpha and 3 from this tensor network operator, so bond dimension 6 PEPS. And then you get these results here. The red line is the expectation value of x, the yellow line, the expectation value of BP. And then there's this blue line, which seems to behave as an order parameter, which we know does not exist for topological phase transitions. But that's actually indeed some quantity that measures this explicit or spontaneous breaking of this virtual symmetry at the level of the tensor matrix. So that's another thing that casting this whole formalism into PEPS gives you as a benefit. The first thing was this entanglement Hamiltonians. The second thing is that it gives you some kind of virtual order parameters which work both for conventional phase transitions as well as for topological phase transitions. How am I doing on time? Let me just quickly mention, so this is a case where we cannot really do the perturbation expansion from both sides, because in this case, our H1 would indeed be a very non-trivial state, which is gapless, which cannot easily be captured by a simple product state or a simple PEPS. So here we just did, starting from the Niel state, just did a first order perturbation expansion, and with this term, cast this into a variational state. So with just one free parameter, basically, this gives you d equal 2 PEPS. And this shows the energy starting from the Niel point, where it's of course, exact, and then all the way down to the Heisenberg antiferromagnet, where the energy itself is, well, not too bad. If you look at the magnetization, it's not very good, but it's still pretty good all the way basically up to like lambda 1 over lambda 0 equal to 0.5. So this is just one parameter d equal 2 PEPS. It actually turns out if you look at the numerically, look at the results of the full d equal 2 PEPS simulation, it gives you the same result. So just this ansatz basically captures what is the best d equal 2 PEPS that you can have.
You know, I'm trying to figure out, so are you saying here is a variational approach based on perturbation theory?
Inspired by perturbation theory, yes.
But with perturbation theory alone, you will not be able to manage this?
No. Well, and then you don't. So I think, for example, the perturbative result for the energy at lambda 1 over lambda 0 equal 1, so at the Heisenberg point, it's lower, but that doesn't tell you anything. It's a perturbative energy. You have no idea whether it's, I mean, it's lower. I think so. It's just the first order perturbative. And then you would calculate the second order perturbative energy, and it would jump up. And
so here you have a variational wave function.
So here you have a variational wave function. You have a variational energy.
And the advantage to regular PEPS is that it's very guided, very small number of additional parameters.
Yes, and it gives you some kind of physical interpretation to the parameters in PEPS, which is certainly a critique that you hear sometimes, that it's, I mean, very hard to give some kind of physical meaning to I mean, tensor networks in general as a framework, to give some kind of meaning to the parameters in these tensors. In this case, you can directly link it to certain, I mean, operators that you apply physically and which are inspired by perturbation theory. Okay, so as a summary, so inspiration from perturbation theory can be used to construct low parameter families. This is a general principle which is not specific to tensor networks, which has been used in other domains. But tensor networks is what in this case, in the case of quantum many-body systems on lattices and hopefully also in the future for quantum field theories, allows you to actually compute expectation values with these wave functions. And then it does provide some additional benefits other than just being able to actually calculate something. So as I showed, it often allows you to define these virtual order parameters, which even work for topological phase transitions. And it also defines your natural Hilbert space for defining entanglement Hamiltonians. And so that's in the theme of this conference, just one idea. Well, perturbation theory is, of course, it's not specific to quantum field theory, but I would say it's very present in the quantum field theory. So it's one particular idea from quantum field theory that we could basically import into tensor networks and then have some kind of return benefits from this. And so the question is, can we import other ideas and methodology from field theory and vice versa? I mean, how can we further exploit this synergy between tensor networks and quantum field theory? And so one other idea, which is that I think looks very promising, is to, for example, construct path integrals using the overcomplete basis of tensor network states, so where you would write basically your identity as an integral over all tensor network states of a given family, like all the MPS of a given bond dimension. And so this was actually described in this nice paper by Andrew Green and collaborators. And so in that framework, what you would get is that basically the variationally optimal tensor network would just be like the semi-classical approximation, but it will already have correlations and entanglement. And then all the fluctuations in the path integral would allow you to develop an effective theory of fluctuations around this tensor network approximation, which, for example, you could use as a way to improve your tensor network approximation. That's also the idea of coupled clustering in quantum chemistry, where you need to consider fluctuations on top of your Hartree-Fock ground state, or of the random phase approximation. So if this can be developed, it will allow you, instead of pushing tensor network simulations with a very high bond dimension, just to have a tensor network with a mediocre value of the bond dimension, which just captures the right physics. But then if you want to get good accuracy, you would, get some kind of corrections around this from this fluctuation theory. But then you could also do a lot of other things with this, and in the spirit of what ideas from tensor networks, maybe one can define or develop some kind of formalism of Feynman diagrams to indeed improve these tensor network simulations. One can import the idea of instantons and Berry phases. So I'm sure there's a lot of interesting ideas that still need to be investigated and can be exploited. So with this, I'd like to conclude my talk.
Questions?
Yes.
Do you think you could be able to build a dictionary between Feynman diagrams and tensor networks?
A dictionary is not so much what I have in mind because the original Feynman diagrams are about correcting on top of a mean field state and momentum space, which is not what we're going to use tensor networks for. It's rather that, there might be a way to cast indeed starting from this path integral over MPS. So what this would do is it would allow you to build some kind of quantum theory, some kind of quantized theory where your quantum degrees of freedom would actually be the parameters in your tensor. The variational tensor network approximation would just be like indeed some kind of product state, some kind of classical state in that formalism. And then you could develop perturbation theory on top of this. And maybe this indeed can be cast again into some kind of formalism of propagators and Feynman diagrams. That's what the statement was referring to.
Have you thought about So you've shown that you can approach critical points or cross them or whatever using this approach. Have you thought about looking at it as an inverse RG flow? That's a kind of continuum.
We haven't really studied the RG flow associated with this. So how would you?
Well, this is only based on the very simple idea in my head that you know, when you're approaching a critical point, this is kind of like going to a continuum. Right? So if you do this in a particular way, if you have some set of or some flow in these parameters that you were talking about.
Yeah, it's something we haven't considered, definitely. Maybe, I guess so, because in the end, it's really a dressing of this mean field state. So, and this is something that is also, well, I mean, there was quite a while ago already a paper by Sandvik who indeed studied that just for MPS, if you want to extract critical exponents, there are, I mean, especially now, very, very good ways of doing this. But if you indeed would just look at, for example, something like this order parameter, this magnetization, you would zoom in very close to the phase transition, you actually recover mean field critical exponents. But then there's, of course, this wide range where you would actually find the correct critical exponent, like the 1/8 and 1V. If you look at a wide range, but if you really zoom into the, and I think he really had to use like high precision numerics, like high precision digits, etc., to show this or to do this. But then you actually always recover the mean field behavior, and well, that was the point of that paper. And in some sense, I think this is the same here and with any tensor network simulation. But here it's very explicit that indeed what we're doing is dressing this kind of mean field state. So in that sense, I guess the continuum theory that you get out of this would conceptually be similar to one that you would get from doing the same proposal for just the mean field results.
Okay. Oh, one more.
Good. I understand what you did. Maybe it's some kind of resummation of perturbation theory.
Yes. Certainly. So the size extensivity, in a sense, is equivalent to saying that if you want to do perturbation theory, like quantum field theory, you want to do it at the level of the effective action, not at the level of the partition function. These kind of things. So indeed, you really want to do resummation. You want to look at 1PI diagrams and these kind of things. So that's kind of the wave function version of that statement.
Okay, let's thank you again.